This episode of The Imposter is sponsored by Sonos, who just introduced a new home speaker system called the Sonos One. I just got a couple of Sonos One speakers to try out, and even though they're pretty small and discreet, they kind of fill up the room with sound in a way that makes listening to music in your living room this absorbing, immersive experience. To get 10% off any order of $2,500 or less, go to Sonos.com, promo code IMPOSTER10. This episode is also sponsored by Endy, the Canadian-made online mattress company that makes its own memory foam. It's called Endy Foam, and it features this thing called motion transfer resistance, which is a fancy way of saying that if your partner or, I don't know, your Tinder date is rolling around next to you, you're not going to feel it. To get $50 off any Endy mattress, go to endy.ca/theimposter and enter the promo code IMPOSTER at checkout. From Canada Land, this is The Imposter, and I'm Aaliyah Pabani. In Montreal, in this big glass building just off the Descadie Highway, in an office space that looks kind of like any other IT solutions company, like if you go to their website, they've even got PNGs of rotating gears next to the description of their services, you'll find the back end of the mainstream online porn industry. It's a company called MindGeek. And if you think that name sounds a bit unsavory, the company's former name was Manwin. MindGeek owns the internet's biggest porn sites. This includes tube sites like Pornhub and RedTube and YouPorn, and adult film production companies like Digital Playground and Brazzers. At MindGeek, they manage their assets just like any other highly trafficked site. They tag videos with particular combinations of specific keywords. Things like babysitter and interracial. And then they do A/B testing to see how they perform. They do affiliate marketing. They've mastered the art of search engine optimization so that when you Google porn, their sites are the first ones that show up. But I'm sure you already know that. As long as there's been porn, there's been surface level takes on the morality of it. But stories about online porn so often focus on the economics of it. Stories like how MindGeek turned free online tube sites into a multi-billion dollar business, and what that did to the livelihoods of porn stars in studios hundreds of miles away from their glossy offices. But you don't hear nearly as much about the production of porn as a creative process, as an act of resistance, or in the context of building community. On this episode, you'll hear from two people who engage with porn as a medium for self-exploration, for business and for pleasure, and find themselves transformed by the process. And I should say here that this episode includes clips of porn, people talk about sex and body parts, and also rape is mentioned, just so you know. First, the age-old question. How do you make arty erotica when you're working at a huge porn corporation?
I'm Esther Splett, and I used to write porn scripts for a living, and I'm also a musician and artist.
When Esther was fresh out of her creative writing undergrad, she applied for a job writing porn scripts for the MindGeek adult film company, Brazzers.
I really didn't know much about mainstream porn, and I messaged one of my cousins because I didn't have enough straight male friends to be like, is this weird or is this what straight men like?
Okay, so if you're not familiar, Brazzers is this membership-based site that's known for polished, roughly 30-minute, narrative-driven, HD films. And the acting's comparatively not bad. Even though Esther was unfamiliar with the product, she submitted a couple of sample scripts and a cover letter, and she got the job. She was excited to write scenes that were inspired by the work of some of her favorite film auteurs.
Vertigo, based on Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo. Summary. Girl 1 develops an obsession with the image of a porn star who died tragically and becomes possessed by the spirit of the star. When she's possessed, she wanders around the city in a trance, fucking whomever she encounters. When confronted with large cocks, however, it is too much, and she spirals into vertigo and goes into a frenzy. Her husband is a doctor who discusses her case with a private eye with a big cock, who he's hired to follow her around. Will the PI be the only man with a cock large enough to snap her out of her spell? I guess, like, the thing that I'd get criticized for was, like, the story part of my script was, like, too long, or, like, writing, like, over convoluted stories, and then they'd, like, dumb it down or take parts out, and I'd get, like, kind of, like, pissed off.
And I mean, they weren't necessarily wrong for expressing concern.
There was, like, one I wrote where, like, a janitor was coming over to, like, fix someone's plumbing, and I was like, well, you can't just do that. That's, like, such a cliche. So then I, like, made it so they're, like, the janitor was, like, secretly, like, a private investigator, and then, like, but he was, like, dressing up as a janitor, and, like, he was, like, coming to, like, assassinate her, but, like, dressed up as a janitor, and then she was in the mob or something. And then I just, like, took all the other stuff out and, like, left the janitor stuff. And I was like, that's what I was making fun of. And that's, like, the only part that you use. There was definitely overlap in, like, what I was, like, into in the porn. Because I'm, like, turned on by, like, fucked up, like, power dynamics. So then I would, like, explore those a lot. There was, like, a lesbian site. It was called Hot and Mean, and then, like, the premise is, like, one of the, like, lesbians was, like, a mean, like, bitchy one, and the other one was, like, a more, like, innocent, virginal one, and then, like, the mean, bitchy one, like, came and, like, fucked the other one. Like, lesbian porn, like, really catered to straight men, but the way that I wrote some of the scripts were as if, like, the one who was, like, the mean one was, like, bullying the other woman because she was, like, had, like, repressed homophobia and, like, couldn't, like, deal with being in love with the other women, and I, like, got really into those scripts.
But, of course, when you're working out of a cubicle in a corporate building off the highway, you're gonna hit a wall. At Brazzers, Esther had to write for a range of different sites, and one of them was this now-defunct site called Porn Star Punishment. And it specialized in what fans refer to as rape porn. And Esther doesn't have a problem with rape scenes, as long as it's made clear that it's a fantasy. It's detached from real life. But it didn't always feel like it was being received that way by the people watching it.
Some of the stories for that site were, like, really awful, where it was just like, this bitch, like, made my sandwich badly, or was, like, talking during, like, the hockey game and is, like, annoying, so I'm gonna, like, fuck her. And it was just, like this thing that was, like, obviously rape, but then there were arguments on, like, the forum where men didn't, like, get that it was rape, and that really bothered me.
So Esther started trying to insert what she perceived as subversive messaging into otherwise pretty conventional porn narratives whenever she got a chance. Like, for this one video, she had to write a doctor-patient scenario that also had to make use of the star's extensive wig collection. It's called Dr. Doppelfucker.
Please, eat your breakfast. You have to eat. You know he cannot hear you.
We don't know that.
So the premise is there's this, like, guy who has, like, emotional problems related to sex, and anytime he has sex, he goes into, like, a coma and has to go to the hospital, and he has this, like, specialist doctor who comes and, like, tries to, like, fix his issues.
Johnny. You're back again. My favorite patient. A sexual response. Very good. Looks like we'll need the usual treatment.
She does this, like, special therapy where she dresses up as all his, like, ex-girlfriends, wearing, like, different wigs. And all his ex-girlfriends are, like, sexist archetypes, like, one
I'm your first girlfriend. I was a virgin, and I was scared it was going to be too big.
And then at the end of the script, he's like, thanks, I'm, like, cured. I'm going to, like, go out and, like, bang some, like, bitches or whatever. And then she's like, no, you're not cured. You have, like, some serious problems with women.
Dr. Vaughn, that was amazing. I've never came so much. I can't wait to get out of here and go bang some sluts. I'm cured.
You'll never be cured, Johnny, unless you fix your issues with women. I've told you a million times.
Well, why don't you treat me outside of the hospital on a regular basis? I mean, I really want to work on my issues.
Okay, Johnny, meet me next Monday in my office. We'll talk about it.
Okay.
On top of writing the scenes, a lot of writers would post about their work or interact with the porn stars from their films on social media.
Porn Twitter is already kind of like surreal and weird. Like, everyone will be like, it's like Titty Tuesdays. Like, here are my big tits.
Elements of her work started making its way into her art.
At the time, I, like, also was, like, starting to play music a lot for the first time in a band. The character I had for one of my bands was, like, an alien who's, like, trying to, like, learn about sex from, like, porn or something. And it, like, doesn't quite, like, make sense and is, like, trying to be sexy but, like, doing it wrong. And it's really weird and gross.
I'm your kid sister, pulling at your sleeve.
The line between Esther's job and her artwork was getting increasingly blurry. There were pitch meetings every 2 weeks, and because most of those pitches would get rejected, writers had to come with a pile of ideas.
Outside of work, I just found myself constantly, like, brainstorming or, like, stressed out about, like, coming up with enough new porn ideas. And then
if she was at a party and someone said something about going to a protest, she'd be thinking about how to script a protest scene where everyone ends up having sex. The socio-political climate of the day just became fodder for more porn.
Hot loan broker babes are doing their part to help out during the long recession, but they like to play dirty, giving high-interest loans to stressed-out dads. It may be the recession, but their tits are still ample and bountiful, even if the economy isn't. Girl 2, we'd like nothing more than to come to a financial agreement with you. Guy 1,
I'd like that, but your interest rates are sucking me dry.
Girl 1 to Girl 2, hear that? We're sucking him dry.
Eventually, the feeling of being surrounded on the daily by images and videos of this particular kind of performative sexuality started feeling a bit like an endurance test. And after her 6-month contract was up, she didn't get renewed.
I think, like, after I left the job, I just, like, for, like, a couple months after, I was, like, I have, like, no interest in, like, sex or, like, thinking about sex. And, like, that lasted for a while where I was so burned out. I was, like, I can't even, like, think about sex anymore.
Esther still wants to make porn, but you don't really see industry listings for scriptwriters anymore. The number of studios making high-budget, scripted narrative films with big stars have dwindled. And it's because their videos got pirated and circulated on tube sites for free. And there's also more amateur, self-uploaded, and webcam stuff for people who want something more spontaneous and interactive. If you spend any time online, it's easy to feel like there's just this monolithic corporate fantasy world that's surrounded by smaller pockets of anonymized, user-generated content. And even though many of us consume porn in some form, for most, it feels far removed from our day-to-day lives. But there's a growing number of people who are taking a different approach. You could almost call it small batch porn. After the break, you'll hear from someone who saw her future in the diary of feminist porn pioneer Candida Royale. Now, she hires her friends to make DIY porn out of her apartment in Montreal, and they make a living wage doing it. This episode of The Imposter is sponsored by Sonos. They just introduced a new speaker system called the Sonos One. I've got two Sonos Ones, one in my living room and one in my kitchen. They're white, they're somewhere between a cylinder and a box, and they're by far the most future-facing object in my entire apartment. It's the beginning of summer, so I bought myself some yellow tulips, and now each of my speakers sits next to a bouquet of yellow tulips. I've been waking up in the morning, and before I do anything, I make myself a coffee and I play something from both speakers so that the sound kind of floats through and fills up my apartment in this way where you don't really know where the sound's coming from anymore. These days, I've been listening to the song Texas from Jennifer Castle's new album, Angels of Death. I think about summer and the feeling of driving away and being forced into the moment because you're far away and it's hot, and the only thing you can do is stare into the distance. If you're looking for some great speakers that will change the way you listen to music, try the Sonos One. You can get 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product on Sonos.com. The offer is available for a limited time and cannot be combined with any other discounts and promotions. Go to Sonos.com and enter the promo code IMPOSTER10, that's IMPOSTER in all caps, and then the number 10, for 10% off your order. This episode of The Imposter is also sponsored by Endy, the Canadian-made online mattress company that makes their own memory foam. They call it Endy Foam. Endy Foam makes it so that when you're sleeping beside someone who rolls around a lot, you're not going to wake up. They call that motion transfer resistance. For some reason, the go-to test for motion transfer resistance has always been to drop a bowling ball on the mattress and then drop another one right beside it to see if it moves. But human beings aren't bowling balls, so I asked my friends Mick and Gina, my own personal Endy mattress product testers, what it's like to share a mattress.
I am so sleepy. It's like 6 o'clock Pacific time.
She has a wonderful way of conserving body heat, which means that while her core is warm, her butt on the outside is like a frozen icicle.
You know, they try like 200 different micro positions, just like shifting this way, shifting that way, leg out here, arm out there.
Sleeping with another human can be a great privilege, but there are a lot of variables. If you want a mattress that can handle it, try an Endy. For $50 off any Endy mattress, go to endy.ca/theimposter and enter the promo code IMPOSTER at checkout.
There's no like easy answer. It wasn't like I woke up one day and was like, oh, I'm going to be a porn star when I grow up and tried to get there. I think it actually took a lot of unpacking of my own horror phobia and my own resentment of porn. And kind of, I think a lot of those. I'm Ali Oops, and I am an independent porn producer, performer, editor, and creator, basically. So I do at-home pornography based here in Montreal. I mean, you can, like, quote me 4 years ago being like, I don't do porn, even though I was doing pretty much almost everything that porn is, making masturbation videos, being fully publicly engaging in sexual acts on camera, and still was very resentful and rejecting that term, which I would say is, like, engaging in the hierarchy, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's been a long journey to get to a point where I'm very confident and happy with doing porn and kind of laugh at my growth over the years.
Mm. I'm curious to go back to, did you say the word horarchy?
Yeah. Well, I think the horarchy can have a couple, I think it's used in a couple different ways. The horarchy is like a hierarchy. It's a play on that term, maybe obviously. And within the sex work community, some people are more privileged than others. So being a dominatrix, for example, I would say be one of the, or a sugar baby, are two of the kind of top dogs on the horarchy, the people who experience the least amount of stigma and also gain a lot from sex work. I think it was very much a survival tactic of people being like, are you doing porn, whether it's my family or my friends, and a way to tell them I'm doing this, but it's not that horrible, bad other thing that everyone hates.
Alley-Oops's work isn't really like anything I'd ever seen before. It kind of feels like you're at a DIY punk show. Allie brings that vibe to porn. It's shot in a kind of raw documentary style, mostly in her apartment, in her room, with lots of quick cuts and improvising. She's dressing and undressing. She moves fluidly between being in the scene and throwing casually to her friends. She's talking to the camera. She's smoking weed and blows the camera person a kiss. And then someone giggles off screen. Some schmaltzy music. There's POV stuff where she's sucking on the fingers of a person holding the camera with birds chirping outside. The performers are mic'd so close, and the sound is so clear, that it almost feels like you're in bed with her. And then, in another scene, she's at the kitchen sink washing a range of dildos in various shapes and sizes and putting them in the dish rack to dry. The whole thing's playful and unguarded. Allie's deeply comfortable, like she's hanging out. And it's because she is. This is the kind of space that's only possible when the performers get to decide what their scenes look like, and when all the people on set can trust each other and are paid a living wage to contribute to the creative process. And that makes the viewing experience pleasurable in a different kind of way. Like you could see yourself in that room.
I mean, when I first started shooting, it was my roommate who does these like pornographic collages, and she's really into porn, and I hadn't really met someone who was as interested in explicit sexual images as me at that time, and she was super down to shoot whatever, so she started shooting my masturbation videos or different kind of erotic photos, and so I'm not exactly sure how we even came up with it, but I remember how strange it was being in a room with three of my friends and just doing like a hand job, like massage, masseuse, like happy ending video. And yeah, it was bizarre. I mean, having sex in front of your friends within any capacity was a new experience for me. And now in this last shoot I did in Toronto, I like barely even noticed the cameras were there. So it's funny to kind of have that working relationship and see how much my friendships have really changed and evolved through my friends just being kind of in on this secret part of my life that is no longer a secret. It's fun. I mean, on that shoot, I remember like trying to spit on this person's penis and missing, and the camera, my friend who has the camera is like 2 inches from my face, and like we both start cracking up because she saw exactly how embarrassing that was. And so I do think my sets, which I think are different than most sets from what I hear, are incredibly lighthearted, very funny. There's a lot of space. We don't take ourselves too seriously. We're incredibly self-aware that we're shooting a porn. So the way we edit them is like, we'll leave in moments where maybe the camera people might say something or knock something over, or we constantly remind you that there's like a lot of people in the room, which is very anti-porn because porn is kind of about making a fantasy and selling that fantasy. So to a lot of people who consume like more fetish or kink porn, they're like, that's like not what I want at all, because I want to be sold that this fantasy is there. I'm trying to reach a very different market, which is very humanizing of the porn industry, that's saying, look at what we're doing behind the scenes. there's actually a lot of people here and we're having fun. And so we have a lot more fluidity on the sets in that sense, because we are actually kind of like looking for that fun and for those like blooper reels. Like I make blooper reels, stuff like that.
And
you want to keep playing?
Yeah.
Too bad.
We killed him.
I hear my friends complain about coworker drama all the time, and I don't have that. I think I've paid my friends out in the last year and a half more money than could be imaginable, because I pay all of them. So not only do they get to like come work on set with me, everyone gets paid livable wages, and I think everyone grows in the process. So on the last shoot, for example, I had a friend who's like a huge porn fan but has never worked on a porn set, and I invited her on set, and she was like our PA, and she went home and watched porn and just started crying and said it was a hugely transformative experience for her. And we do get that feedback a lot. I get that feedback a lot, because when we think of porn sets, we think of these incredibly exploitative environments. And most of my friends who are just civilians, meaning like non-sex workers, come onto set and are a woman-dominated, queer-dominated set, where if a cis man is on board, he's a performer who's very much for our use and not really a part of the decision-making, or is not part of the team that holds the most power. And it's been really cool to bring my friends on and know that they're going to take that knowledge and defend pornography in whatever way, shape, and form through being a part of it. And that's a really powerful experience to kind of give other people, but also to really help grow and deepen friendships and change what it means, like what is sex if you share it with everyone, and what does it mean to have sex with your friends and not be romantically attracted to them. It can be a very transformative experience for friendships if you allow that space to be open.
For people who have only ever like experienced porn through like a couple videos on Pornhub or something, if you could kind of like describe the work that you do and like what your process is and what it looks like.
Yeah, that's a great question. So when I think of mainstream porn, which is more of the Pornhub side, I think of basically a production company hiring you as a performer. So there's a production company, they say, we're gonna do this porn, let's say it's like, I don't know, hot teen girl has sex with the mailman or something. And then, you know, they come up with that concept and then they hire you as a performer, they pay you right there, maybe you make $2,000 in a day's work, and then you walk away, you don't own any rights to the project. So the contrast with that in kind of independent porn is you take on, you're wearing seven hats. So I produce and direct, which means I'm the one coming up with the concept. So I'm like, we're gonna do this. And then I put together a team and I set all the dates, and then we show up and I have all the equipment and we shoot and I help direct the film, and then when we leave I edit the porn, no one else does it for me, and then I distribute it on my own channel. So while you gain maybe in some ways more agency and more power over the script, over the team, there's all these other like kind of downsides where you're doing a lot more work, and you usually don't make as much money.
As you might expect, in mainstream porn, the amount you get paid depends on how famous you are. Allie says that she would get about $2,000 for a one-day shoot on an independent film. But it's really hard to generalize that because, just like in every other industry, the imbalances in the world are reflected in your paycheck. In a recent interview with Hey Iris, porn performer Nikki Darling pointed out a glaring double standard.
There is less work and less pay when you are a Black female performer. One thing that people don't talk about in porn a lot is there actually are like white female performers that will actually charge more of a rate for doing IR. And IR stands for interracial. And interracial is not just having sex with an Asian person or having sex with a Latin person. It specifically is for having sex with a Black person on camera, which for me as a Black female performer, I don't get to charge double for every time I fuck a white person on camera, which I would be rolling in hella dough because that's 90% of my scenes.
I wanted to know whether Ali was making a good living off DIY porn and what it took to get there.
It's cute because when people are like, how do I get into porn? That's like my number one asked question. And I'm like, don't do it. It's so hard. It took me like 4 years of building a platform to make like a livable wage. Mm. So it takes, you have to like build a name and build a platform and have people want to buy your work and what makes your work different than other people's, for example, stuff like this. So it's a lot of self-branding and self-marketing. Porn's a pretty simple market. You can pretty much guess what's gonna sell. But yeah, I mean, it depends on the porn. When I shoot like a main, like straight porn that like plays into straight concepts that we know sell, right. Those porns do great. I make a lot of money. They're fine. but I mostly am making like queer and trans porn, which is a huge reason why I'm in Montreal. I made a porn with a trans man performer last summer. And while it was the porn that gained so much attention from festivals, from screenings, from, you know, the community, I didn't even break even. Not even close. I was a full loss on the project, which is fine. I like to believe and pray and hope the more we make queer porn, the more it will become sustainable as we reach the audiences in which we want to reach. But it's hard to say because that doesn't sell. And does that mean we shouldn't make it because it doesn't sell? And this is a big question I have, especially among queer pornographers in the DIY scene, is, okay, the queer feminist porn circuit is incredibly small. And then the people who know about it are like incredibly privileged. They're usually within the porn circuit or one removed from people making that kind of work. And so, like, how are we helping the, like, young trans kid in Ohio figure out their identity when we don't leak any of it for free? It's, like, you have to usually pay to see independent porn. Mm. It's not free because of how much it costs to make. So then we kind of end up in this echo chamber, right? And I do feel like indie queer porn is the epitome of an echo chamber where we're all circle jerking each other off for doing this like really important work that like no one knows about except for us. And so
are there other models that could change that? Like, could you get like could you make your work like Patreon supported or like available for free for certain people? Or like, are there any ideas around how to change that?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us talk about releasing stuff on Pornhub. But that's a huge risk and loss. To release your work on Pornhub means usually outing yourself globally, which is a huge amount of stigma for a lot of people who maybe parents or family don't know or whatever, or even the implications of traveling. A lot of countries don't allow porn stars into their country. But, you know, like right now I can go into for example, I just went to Singapore. They have a huge ban on porn there. And I mean, no one knows who I am, but if I was on Pornhub.com, I have a feeling someone might know who I am, right? So like your visibility can really change your access to movement and to spaces, stuff like that. So there's a huge risk of like putting yourself out there on that level where it's so complicated. And I think kind of what I'm doing right now is I'm actually partnering with Pornhub on a project that I hope will kind of shift things. I don't want to talk too much about it because it's not the dotted line isn't signed, but there are ways that we can, you know, to me, Pornhub is a really evil company. Most porn performers, especially indie porn performers, hate MindGeek and hate Pornhub and the Tube sites. So me even like walking into their office and having a meeting is an incredibly controversial thing among indie porn performers. But to me, again, these conversations and partnering with them are the ways to kind of end this echo chamber and say, okay, you have money. We have the politics. How do we make a middle ground where we can get paid for doing that work? The performer we just shot with in Toronto named Rooster, who's super cool, actually hit me up to do a film with me, and I was like panicking because I was like, we don't know what we're doing. And this like legit porn performer who knows everyone and works in everything in the feminist sector like wants to work with us. Okay, let's do it.
Do you like it when it's rainy here? Or do you like it like...
On this particular shoot, I wanted to focus on consent. Porn performers do so much pre-negotiation consent that it's sometimes... I find when watching my films back, we don't say anything to each other about, like, anything, because we've spent at this point 3.5 hours talking about our boundaries. So it's like, okay, mm-hmm. we're there. We know, hopefully, a pretty good understanding of what's going to happen. And so I wanted to bring that back into this production. So it's really cute. I have like 9 full minutes of us just talking about consent that we tried, like me having a strap on and me being like, wow, I need to like go to the gym before I ever try that again. Or Rue spanking me and being like, do you want it harder? How does it feel? And I'm like, yeah, you can go harder.
Ooh, I like it when you pull my hair.
Yeah.
Check the teeth.
So before I even planned the script, I talked to Rue for about an hour over Skype and got a better idea of what Rue is comfortable with, and that helped build the script. Like what our desires, fantasies are, and what we're willing to do on screen.
Yeah, I get it.
Oh my god.
I think I'm too ridiculous.
I mean, it's going to sound really silly to say out loud, but it's like, we're going to start by making out, and then we're going to take off our clothes really slowly, and then I'm going to give you a blowjob, and then, like, maybe I'll play with your butt, and then we're going to flip me over and do a finger bang scene, and then we'll have penetrative sex, and then, like, how do we want to orgasm, which we decided on this was, like, a mutual masturbation, because we felt like it was really the queerest truth.
Me three.
You can add one more.
The sex is kind of almost fake sex too. We laugh about this a lot, at least for my sets. I mean, you stop and start a lot, so it's like, okay, we're giving this blowjob for like 15 minutes, but there's like 3 cuts because the camera is changing their angle or changing the lens or whatever. So you're like trying as hard as you can to like stay aroused, but it is very performative. It's not this mind-blowing, like, authentic connection between me and the other performer, necessarily.
Culturally, we're kind of getting into, like, discussions around, like, the importance of consent, and I think that what's really nice about what you're doing and that I didn't know that you were doing is kind of, like, incorporating, like, the sexiness and the fun of consent, and this is not, like, something where people are able to access or even see.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like, so important for people to, like, understand that consent doesn't need to be this, like, thing you stress out about, like, that it could actually be something that is really, like, fun and enjoyable and something that you kind of engage in a different way.
Totally. And I have, like, mixed feelings because on one hand, I think porn is held responsible for not showcasing consent in, like, a completely irrational way. Like, porn performers negotiate consent more than anyone else on this planet, guaranteed,
mm-hmm.
Because they're signing contracts before walking on there, knowing exactly what they're going to do. So it's funny how porn in general is so, everyone's so mad at it because it doesn't show consent. And being in the industry, you're like, how could you say that about people who are probably the masters of consent?
Mm-hmm.
But it is exciting to like bring it back in and say, okay, while we don't have to, like, it will be fun. Let's do it anyway. Cause that is more what my sex life looks like. My mentor, who's like this 71-year-old retired porn star from the 80s, she would always say the best porns come from your own personal sex life and what you're going through. And to me, continued negotiated consent is really important. Like, I never have silent sex. Obviously, I talk so much, as you can tell. So silent sex is kind of weird to me.
I'm dying to know more about your mentor.
Yes, Veronica Vera is a fascinating woman who changed my life. She was Candida Royale's best friend, or was, in the sense that Candida Royale passed away about 2.5 years ago. Candida Royale is known as the pioneer for the genre of feminist porn. So she was one of the first and probably most famous women creating feminist porn as a genre. So she was one of the first women production companies to really shift the idea that men had control over the porn industry.
Candida, so now what you're doing is you are actually producing.
Tell me
what you're doing.
I started Femme Productions 2 years ago in order to put a woman's voice into these movies. I wanted to produce and direct movies that represented our fantasies.
I've worked on Candida Royale's archives with Veronica Vera for about a year and a half or 2 years for Harvard University. And I've gone through all of her life's work. I feel like I know her. And then I've studied her pretty intensely post-archives of really unpacking feminist porn and my relationship to it, which now I would say that I don't identify with feminist porn and don't necessarily agree with feminist porn anymore. But it definitely had a significant moment in history, especially in the 80s and 90s, to present day as we evolve into kind of the ethical porn chapter.
I guess I'm wondering about when you say like you've kind of like diverged from feminist porn, it made me, what do you mean when you say like that you don't necessarily agree with feminist porn or like that you've moved beyond that to something else? Like,
I think the shortest version is that feminist porn founded in the 80s by women like Candida Royale originally meant that a porn was either directed and filmed by a woman or it depicted like authentic pleasure in women. Granted, when we're saying women, we're talking about cis women, mm-hmm. and often cis white women. So, I mean, the idea of feminist porn really was to create space for women and to counter the quote unquote male gaze. Mm-hmm. Now, and that was important at that time. I would say that feminist porn and their marketing strategies to gain respectability heavily engaged in the hierarchy, heavily, and still do. And okay, so then we have to kind of break down the male gaze. What does the male gaze mean? And does the male gaze trap us in a gender binary that says all men like something and all women like something? Mm-hmm. And how do we reconcile with that? And so I think ethically made porn counters that conversation and says, okay, does it matter who shoots the porn? Does it matter if the porn is sparkly and pink and well-lit and Petra Collins, like femme gaze or whatever? Like, I feel like labor rights over aesthetics is much more applicable to the entire porn industry. So it doesn't matter if I'm working with Pornhub or if I'm working for myself. What makes ethically made porn to me is how it's marketed. Are you marketing this as a she-male porn? Mm-hmm. Or are you marketing this as a trans porn, mm-hmm. right? Like, things like this that I don't care if you like triple anal porn. If the performers are treated well and paid well and are okay with how it's being distributed, that's ethically made porn to me. So Candida becoming the first kind of woman to run a women-run production company was really significant at the time, but also the more you unpack it and study her, the more you realize that her husband's father was part of the biggest porn company out of Europe, and like she had all of these kind of cards stacked into her favor to be able to become that person. But an incredibly fascinating woman. And Veronica Vera was one of her best friends. They were both porn performers back in the 80s. She mostly works within the trans community, so she's not very well known for her porn work, but she actually has been working with trans women and cross-dressers for 25 years. And she runs a school called Miss Vera's Academy for Boys Who Want to Be Girls. And it's been around since the 80s. Amazing. Or 25 years. Yeah, and or 90s, I guess.
Welcome to Miss Vera's Finishing School for Boys Who Want to Be Girls, the world's first male-to-female cross-dressing academy.
Being able to meet people, sex workers who have lives after sex work is an incredibly important thing, I'd say, because, you know, when you do porn, everyone's like, your life's over. This is it. You're never going to be able to get a job again. You're going to, once you decide to leave this, what are you going to do? I mean, that's the million-dollar question. And Veronica really showed me a life after porn, and not just a life after porn, a life that's informed by liberated queer sexuality your entire life. And Veronica looks like she's like maybe 50, and I'm convinced that all of them look young because they've been having liberated sex their whole life and they haven't been holding back, and they've been kicking it with trans queer people, having trans queer sex, really just powerful women in the industry, of showing that not only do they have a life after porn, but porn made them who they are and made the legacies that they made exist, and they persevered through the stigma. And part of that was reading Candida's journals, which, you know, I got to see her at my age in her mid-20s, you know, kind of first exploring porn in her early 20s, but then And then I watched her grow old and become more grounded and more confident in her craft. And then I read her last journal entry when she died of cancer. So I really saw Candida from 17 to like her full lifespan through these journals. And it was a huge gift to know that my life wasn't over when everyone was saying it was. Elderly, visible sex workers are incredibly important to us young folks who really have this single narrative of how our life's gonna end. Jail, death, or, you know, homeless without any source of income. I'm very grateful for all the people who've come before me and paved the road, because we couldn't even be having these conversations without the Candida Royales and the Veronica Veras.
That was Ali Oops, who's got a lot of friends with benefits. And Esther Splett, who loves a good potluck. If you want to listen to some of Esther's music, if you want to know more about Veronica Vera's School for Boys Who Want to Be Girls, or if you want to watch Ali Oops' porn, go to candlelandshow.com/imp. I produced this episode of The Imposter with Ali Graham, and our managing editor is Kevin Sexton. Our theme music is by Nathan Burley, and Jesse Perlstein did the lovely sound design for this episode. You can find links to more of his sound work in the show notes. And big thanks to Julie Alsop for your help. Follow us on Twitter at Impster, that's I-M-P-S-T-R, and you can follow me at Aaliyah Pabani. I've got about a month to practice my stand-up comedy, so if you know of any good open mics anywhere within the greater Toronto area, DM me. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/candleland. And if you like The Imposter, tell your people about it.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.